Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com during the radio broadcast. And we have the podcasts on the homepage of richarddugan.com. We also have a radio shows page where you can find the programs going back 10 years. And we're also on SoundCloud, iTunes, Facebook, Twitter. I think that covers it. Today's program, I think, is going to be a lot of fun because we're going to be getting into an area that starts to stretch the boundaries, if you will, of understanding of what is and isn't real, so to speak, as far as life is concerned. From the author of a very cool novel called Factor Man. How about this one, folks? One man holds the key to the most revolutionary and powerful technology since the invention of the atomic bomb. Here's what's really interesting. Makes sense that the press would want to interview him. The Chinese government wants to kill him, and the FBI just wants to protect him. But first, they need to find him. Where might he be, and what is this new technology? Well, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to answer those questions, because obviously we want you to pick up a copy of the book. My guest is the author. He is also, can I say, former astrophysicist, and now you are now you're into artificial intelligence, Matt Ginsberg. Thank you so much for joining us on the program.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, are you a former astrophysicist, or are you still practicing?
Well, I mean. You know, can you be a former child molester? I think once you're an astrophysicist, you're an astrophysicist forever.
Well, let's not make that comparison in that way, but I understand. I get your point. Now, what's interesting is this whole aspect of artificial intelligence, which is an area that you chose to go into because you didn't like astrophysics. Why'd you leave?
I wanted to do something that mattered. And the kind I was doing, a combination of astrophysics and quantum physics. And back when I was doing it, it was a competitor with quark theory and what has become completely mainstream these days. And God made a mistake designing the universe that way, because the kind of physics I was doing, I thought, was much more beautiful than quark stuff. So I had a choice. I either could become a mainstream physicist, which involved going back to graduate school for 6 years, or I could do artificial intelligence, which back then, as far as I could tell, involved simply saying you were doing artificial intelligence. So I picked that one.
Okay.
And it was a good choice. It turns out that it's a natural match for my skill set. I've had a great time doing it for the last 30 years, and that one I haven't left.
Now, you made the statement there in that explanation that God made a mistake. First of all, you've probably offended a lot of people, but that's nothing. That's probably nothing new for you or for any of my guests on the program, because they all have their different perspectives. But my question, more to the point, is why do you think God made a mistake?
So, well, first of all, just to deal with all the offended people, I'm sure he didn't make a mistake. But my perception was and is that he made a mistake. The mathematics that we were, physics is mathematics, it's applied mathematics. So when you have a physical theory of something, it rests on a bit of mathematics, and that mathematics can be beautiful and elegant, or it can be hardworking and much less elegant. And the kind of mathematics we were doing to describe the universe the way we were, it was something called twister theory, is just stunningly beautiful. It's just gorgeous. Much more so, I think, than quarks and quantum chromodynamics, which is the name for the theory that includes quarks. And I always want to believe that, given a choice, God will always pick the most beautiful theory. So somehow, since quantum chromodynamics turned out to be right and twister theory turned out to be wrong, my expectation is that quantum chromodynamics will turn out to be beautiful in a way that we do not yet understand. But twister theory was gorgeous in a way that we did understand. And I know it's sort of weird to talk about mathematics as beautiful and elegant, but to a mathematician, that's how it feels. It's just, it's like art. on a good day.
Well, and there is art that comes out of computers because fractals are just that. They are mathematical equations that have been interpreted into visual art. And I like them. I like having them up on my wall. I had a few of those. I still have the posters, as a matter of fact, to some of the fractals going back to the 70s. Very, very cool stuff.
They are. And you have this incredibly simple mathematical thing that makes a fractal. And that's what's so gorgeous, is that there's so much complexity hidden in this really simple description. And for me, at least, that's what makes it so beautiful, is you have this complicated artifact and you untangle it, and at its core, it's simplicity itself.
Well, now, would Sheldon Cooper of the Big Bang Theory have a problem with the fact that you didn't mention string theory? Are these even related?
String theory is built on quantum chromodynamics.
Oh, okay.
So he would be cool.
Okay, very good. All right, well, let's make a shift, because I didn't understand a word you said in the first... No, I'm kidding. I get the gist of it, and I think the one thing that really boggles my mind is this whole concept of dark matter, and that all they have is a theory, that they can use the mathematics to prove that it exists, but they haven't actually found it, unless by this time of this recording, maybe they have found it. But it's like it's been described as, this is the example, the space between the notes of a piece of musical composition.
So I think it's been... We haven't seen it. That's, or at least as of the moment you and I are talking, we haven't seen it. But we know it's there, because at the moment, at least, that's the only explanation that makes the big properties of the universe make sense. And there's lots of stuff that we believe in that we haven't seen.
Well, God. So, I mean, God is one of them, yeah.
Pardon?
God is one of them, you know?
God is one of them, but I'm thinking about things that are physical. So
right.
You and I have never seen a strand of DNA, but we are absolutely sure that it's there.
Okay.
Nobody has really ever seen an atom.
That's true.
Maybe on very special electron micrograph images, you see things that people tell you are atoms, but you're not really looking anymore because of the technology involved in making these observations. And we certainly haven't seen protons and electrons. We've just watched things that imply they must exist. And dark matter is the same. We look at the large-scale structure of the universe, and it really works out a lot more simply if dark matter is there, and we even know how much there is, because we can tell it's there by the effects it's having.
Ah, okay.
And so much of the world, you know, we know it's there because of the effects more than actually, you know, the object itself.
I had a physicist who was sharing with me his concept, a book he had written called The Fifth Dimension. And we were walking back from lunch one afternoon, and he says, I can prove to you the existence of the first, second, and third dimensions, height, width, depth. I cannot prove to you the existence of the fourth dimension, as he sees it, time, but I can prove to you the effect thereof. Of course, then he went on to describe the fifth dimension, and I stopped him as we were walking. I says, the description you gave me, and this is also in his book, the best single word I can come up with that to codify what you just described is God. And he said, absolutely right. He says, I can't prove to you the fifth dimension exists, but I can prove to you its effect. And so I thought, oh, that's interesting. I mean, time in particular, and that's what frustrates me about going on and off daylight saving time. The animals don't care. They don't even know. And I wish we would just leave it alone. It's like, it was great in its time. Thank you very much, Ben, for your contribution for the first 200 years. Can we leave it alone and stop flipping back and forth? I mean, our flipping back and forth on these things is worse than a politician sometimes. I want to jump over to AI, artificial intelligence. Now, actually, I posed this question to my wife. We get into these conversations an awful lot sometimes spiritual, metaphysical conversations. And we're going to be heading in that general direction on this program here today. But Artificial intelligence, obviously with the advent of the computer, and if you want to take it into the modern age, obviously in the 40s and 50s, they even say, though, actually the first computer goes back hundreds, if not maybe thousands of years. I mean, it was extremely primitive by today's standards, but that's what it was. But now science has been able to create what is referred to as artificial intelligence that actually can now learn as it processes information from outside sources, from outside stimuli, just like we do, and can has it gotten to the stage now where it can actually make choices on its own?
So I'm going to disagree with a bunch of that.
Okay, I'm open to that.
Machines don't learn like we do. They don't look at the world like we do. If you want an instance of a machine, a computer, making a decision, quote, on its own, unquote, I'll just point you to your thermostat, which is deciding all by itself to turn the heat on or turn the air conditioning on or what have you. And there's this huge hype around AI and machine learning, and isn't it cool, and it's going to take over the world, and we're at risk. And I don't buy any of that, really. I think that machine learning, imagine that you're trying to play chess. And there are people, when they play chess, they look 20 moves ahead. So a grandmaster will look 20 moves ahead, not very wide. He just looks at his move and the response, and his move and the response, because he knows how to pick the right moves. And a computer will look billions of moves. It'll consider billions of positions in making a move. But imagine I wanted to do it differently. Imagine I wanted to just look at a chessboard and in some magic gestalt way figure out if it was good or bad. Then I could look at all my possible moves, and I could evaluate them all and say, oh, this is the one that leads to the position where I'm going to win. And I just had this magic function that you give it a chess position, and it says whether you're going to win or lose. You could describe such functions with numbers. You say, you know, take the position of the pawn and add 7, and the position of the knight and subtract 3, and multiply by this, and blah, 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 blah. Machine learning is about learning those functions. Now, when you learn the function, you become very powerful as a chess player because you can play perfectly because you know the function. You don't really understand chess. You don't think about chess like we do. And all these machine learning systems are just like this. They're learning numbers that let them model things that happen in the real world. They don't understand them. When you give them more data, they can do a better job learning the numbers. But they're just trying to learn these numbers. Now, people armed with these tools become incredibly powerful, and the machines can become. You know, you can imagine a weapon that believes it can distinguish friend from foe, and it tries to kill the foe and tries to leave the friends alone. That's incredibly powerful. And if it's really good at it, it's a really powerful tool. But they're not like us. They really just look at the world as this mass of numbers that they've learned. My view is that problems like that, where you are learning these really complicated functions, like how to recognize a cancerous cell, problems like that we tend to be not so good at, and machines tend to be good at. And there are lots of examples, and I think the lesson is we're going to solve problems with machines at our side that we could not have solved by ourselves, and the machines couldn't have solved by ourselves, by themselves. You know, I stink at balancing my checkbook. My computer is really good at it. So together, I make one set of decisions, the machine makes other decisions, like is my checkbook in balance, and we can do more than we could have done separately. I think it's an incredibly optimistic notion. These machines are going to fill in what we're terrible at because their structure is different. You know, mm-hmm. They operate at picosecond timescales. You know, they can do 100 billion things a second. we operate at millisecond time scales, but we have, you know, a trillion processors in our head. We're very different architectures. We're going to have different skills, and we're going to complement each other in ways that should be fundamentally positive.
But at the same time, we also have other processes that are going on that are all involuntary, that are going on behind the scenes. In terms of our blood flow, our heart rate, our breathing, nervous system, and on and on and on. Whereas computers, or I'm not sure whether I should be using the word computers or robots or whatever, what the proper term would be, artificial intelligence maybe would be a better way to put it. And I guess the other thing too is what defines. What defines artificial intelligence from the PC I'm sitting in front of right now that I'm using to record our audio for this radio program?
So I don't think, machines have pieces that they're unaware of. They don't know where the electrons are going and that they're plugged in. And, you know, I'm looking at a computer I just built and it has fans going around with colored lights. And it doesn't know that. It doesn't care. Just like we don't know that you know, we sort of care when it shows up, but the fact that we have blood going all over inside our body, we are, relatively speaking, unaware of. As far as, I don't think you can say this machine is intelligent and that machine is not. Because in all probability, there's going to be a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a machine that solves a problem. It balances your checkbook. No, that's not so smart. You have a machine that solves a different problem. It plays chess better than any human can. Well, that certainly seems a lot closer to smart. But it turns out that machine can play chess and it can't really do anything at all other than play chess. And then you can imagine a machine that comes along and it can actually play all these mental games. It can play chess and Go and checkers and poker and bridge and solve crosswords and do all these kinds of things. Well, that's certainly closer to smart, but it's still an incredibly narrow application. And then you have something on Amazon that tells you you liked this book, you liked Factor Man, so you'll probably like this other book. And that seems a little bit like intelligence. But I think we are quite far and likely to remain quite far from the only definition that I actually know of, which is this thing called the Turing test, where you sit down at a terminal, and on the other end is either a person or a computer. And you can type whatever you want, and it gives you answers. And your job, after some amount of time, say half an hour, is to be able to predict reliably whether you were talking to a computer or a person. And if you can't, then the computer was intelligent. So it's this purely experimental definition. But if you think about the number of things, you know, you think the Cubs are ever going to win the World Series again? It has to give you a sensible response. If you ask it to multiply two 11-digit numbers, not only does it have to wait 30 seconds before giving you the answer, but it probably should give you the wrong answer. So imitating a human in this way is incredibly hard. We're nowhere close to doing it. And I don't think we're even headed that way. Because the goal here, as I said earlier, the goal is not to duplicate ourselves. The goal is to make a tool that can stand by us and extend our abilities. And the best way to extend your abilities is not to make something that's strong where you're strong and weak where you're weak. It's to make something that's strong where you're weak. So it's good that a computer can multiply 11-digit numbers in no time at all and gets the right answer every time. And the strengths they're going to have are going to be so inhuman that I don't think there's likely to be any consensus that at some point a machine has transitioned from not intelligent to intelligent. They just become ever more helpful as time passes.
Hmm. So then a computer, even with this aspect of artificial intelligence, is still using what has been referred to, what's become part of the nomenclature, is using nothing more than an algorithm, which is a program in essence, to make these decisions. Could that computer or that artificial intelligence be programmed to make any kind of a decision as to whether or not, in a chess game, using your analogy, I'm going to play to a draw this time as opposed to a win?
So the answer is yes. So machines are just running algorithms. And they're simple algorithms, and they're complicated algorithms, and they can be classified in a bunch of different metrics. It can be argued that we are also just running algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
So we have neurons firing in our head, and they're connected in a particular way, and we don't really understand all of the biochemistry in detail, but we could imagine that we did, and we would find that we were just running algorithms. Now, what's cool is that certain problems are well-suited to certain algorithms, and certain physical machine types are well-suited to certain algorithms. So we are incredibly good at what's called pattern matching, because when we were just getting started, it was really important that we could look at something and in an incredibly short period of time decide, do I want to eat that or do I want to run away? And we had to get that right. If we didn't get that right, we didn't get to have children, and our genes disappeared from the gene pool. It turns out that architectures like ours, a trillion neurons working in parallel, each operating relatively slowly, milliseconds, is really good at pattern matching. Computers are different. They have a handful of processors, even the massively parallel graphical processing units you see in video game machines. We're still talking thousands of processors, not a trillion. But they're really, really fast. They run, you know, a billion times a second. That means they're going to be good at running different kinds of algorithms. What they tend to be good at is sifting through massively complicated problems and just examining a zillion possible answers. But because of that, because they're good at different algorithms, they will be good at solving different classes of problems, whether it's balancing my checkbook. Most computer chess players, the new Google Alpha player is different, but most computer chess players historically have examined billions and billions of positions searching for the best move because they're good at examining billions of positions. They're solving different problems. And some problems are going to be good for pattern matching. Some problems are going to be good for the kind of algorithms that computers come with. Machine learning is interesting because it is in many ways an attempt to get the computer architecture to apply to pattern matching kinds of problems. But we are still better at sort of the big picture kind of thing. Who do I want to vote for in the next presidential election and why? It's a pattern matching. It's an understanding of the world. It's this giant scope kind of problem. But as a candidate, where am I best off placing my next advertising dollar? That's a computer kind of problem. And as long as there are different kinds of problems and we're each good in our own space, I think we will be nothing but cooperators.
Well, this is kind of interesting because it actually puts a bit of a misnomer on a lot of what we've been seeing both in the media, but also obviously television and movies. They're going to, you know, they're going to take it and run with it no matter what. And a lot of people are of the mind that, well, if they are showing it in the movies and on television, then we must be there or we're heading in that direction. You know, just take a look at, you know, all of the advancements. I mean, you look at Star Trek, the original series. Look at the tablets that they were carrying are rather bulky, which is kind of what we had initially. And now we've got the type of tablets they're carrying on next generation and then some. And what I find so fascinating is this obsession with getting the largest, whatever it is, and then getting the smallest, and then shifting back again towards larger and larger. And, you know, it's like these smartphones. They started out very small, and then they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and now it's a tablet, and now it's a 46-inch screen TV that you can touch. And and that technology just blows me away, our ability to put our finger on the screen, which I know has been around for years because there was a broadcast automation system called Scott Radio that you had a touch screen. And I thought, that's a mistake because it would be too easy to do just that, make a mistake by touching the wrong part of the screen and screwing up the radio station's automation. But I'm sure that there must have been, at least I would hope, there were some fail-safes. I want to throw another item into the mix here, but I want to do that when we come back from our break. I'm Richard Dugan, and we're talking right now with with Matt Ginsberg. We're talking about, of course, his novel, which is Factor Man. We encourage you to pick up a copy. Matt, what website would we go to aside from Amazon? Do you have a website that we would want to link to get people to go there?
It's just mattginsberg.com.
Oh, so easy. M-A-T-T.
Couldn't be any simpler. Yep.
Right.
MattGinsberg.com.
All right. Very good. We're going to come back and continue our conversation. Got more I want to ask him as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, along with Matt Ginsberg, author of Factor Man. He is an astrophysicist. That's where your PhD is. Do you have a PhD yet in AI?
No.
Are you going to go for it?
No.
No? Okay.
I've got 100 published papers. I'm a fellow of the Association for the Advancement of AI. I think probably I'm okay without a second PhD. I have no idea what I would do with that. I don't even know where my first one is at this point.
Is there any reality or validity to the theory that we are able to graft or embed, or I don't even know what the term would be, someone's DNA, their consciousness into computers, into some type of AI to continue living on? And I think specifically of the wonderful, I'm going to call it sci-fi program, called Westworld.
Today, no. But if I had to guess, I would say it is probably the case that the first humans to achieve immortality will do it that way, by somehow having somebody do a complete scan of their brain and digitize them.
You mean I won't be able to do it by meditating and eating kale and doing yoga?
I'm sorry. I meant the first people who achieve immortality and are happy about it will do it that way.
I like the proviso. Very, very nicely done. But let's talk a little bit about the aspect of consciousness. Now, there are those, I mean, you even made the comment during the last segment that, in essence, you know, it could be argued that we're just running algorithms, which means that we're just very complex machines, biochemical machines, as opposed to electronic, if you will. Or electromagnetic, I guess, maybe. I don't know if that's more precise or not. But what about this aspect of consciousness? Is that something that that you have looked at as far as this whole concept surrounding artificial intelligence and somehow grafting the two together?
So now you get the astrophysicist back.
Ah, good.
I think the biggest lesson of 20th century physics was that a distinction that you can never test experimentally is meaningless. And that turns out to be the bedrock of quantum mechanics. And the Heisenberg uncertainty principle basically says you cannot simultaneously know exactly where something is and how fast it's going, because there's no way. The way you see things is you bounce stuff off them, and if you bounce so much stuff off a little pebble that you know exactly where it is, you have no idea how fast it's going because it's reacting to all the bouncing. So if you can't, even in theory, answer a question experimentally, the question itself is meaningless. So my answer to you is that this notion of consciousness is entirely a fiction, because there is no experiment I could imagine doing that would tell me if an entity is conscious or not. So if you go back to this imitation game, the Turing test that I described, mm-hmm. where somebody is trying to, you know, a computer is trying to pretend to be a person at the other end of a line, how could you possibly tell whether or not this entity you're communicating with is conscious? You could ask it, you could say, are you conscious? And it replies, you bet. Are you? And but there's no experiment I could do that. There's consciousness isn't a quality that I can define in an experimental way. And if I believe in the lessons of the physics of the last century, that means you shouldn't even really talk about it, because it doesn't mean anything. And if you view it just as a set of behaviors, well, a computer can exhibit those behaviors in theory as easily as we can.
Well, I know that I've seen some, for example, a news magazine I was watching some time ago. They had Japan had perfected to a certain degree this. I'm going to say it was a machine. It was a computer that was covered in a human body, and this guy was carrying on a conversation. And I thought, wow, what? This is really kind of spooky because, you know, you have to wonder. I mean, I take a look at computer animation these days, or virtual reality is actually the next level, I guess. And I'm thinking, how can I be sure that what I'm watching on television, when it says this is the 5 o'clock news from ABC, NBC, CBS, or whatever, how can I be sure that those are real human beings and those are real images and they didn't create them inside of a computer, i.e. a holodeck? And I've got to look up into the sky and say, computer, end program, because none of it's real anymore. And I don't know what to trust. I mean, you know, we've heard for the last 3 years this term called fake news. Well, how about fake reality?
So, same answer. Right, every now and then, some high school kid will think he's come up with this great theory that we're all just part of a computer simulation, mm-hmm. probably from some other high school kid 200 years more advanced than we are. And isn't that profound? And there's no test you can do. There's no way you can figure out if we are real or if we're just part of a simulation. So my answer is stop worrying about it.
Mm.
You're never going to sort it out. You can't sort it out. All you can do is waste brain cells, and it doesn't matter. The question is meaningless because it's untestable.
Right.
And I believe that fundamentally about everything. If you cannot tell me what experiment could I do that even at least in theory would allow me to conclude that something is true or not, then the question of whether or not it's true doesn't matter.
Well, that's very interesting. I want to get back to your book, Factor Man. And obviously, we want people to pick up a copy by going to mattginsburg.com. What can you tell us? And if you can't tell us, then say so and just say, hey, get a copy of the book. What about this new technology? Can you give us any kind of a hint as to what that is? And is it fictional completely, or is there some basis in reality for this new technology this fellow has?
Well, first of all, everybody should get a copy of the book. That's easy.
Okay.
As far as the new technology, Factor Man is actually, I wrote it in a very lazy way. There's a particular problem I've been working on essentially my entire career as a computer scientist, and it involves finding a very specific algorithm that has very specific properties, but those properties mean that you can use the algorithm to practically solve anything. Play a perfect game of chess, break any code. And over the past 30 years, which is about how long I've been doing it, about once every 6 years, probably once a decade, I think I've solved it. I think I have that algorithm. And I get all excited. I also get nervous because it's way too much power for one guy to have. And finally I said, okay, you know what? I'm going to write a book about somebody who's actually done this. And I took my world. And the only change I made was that I had actually solved it. Turns out, I mean, somebody, I modeled him on me, mm-hmm. had actually solved this, and then I played out what it would be like. But I was able to do things like said, oh, whoever has this is going to need a lawyer. That's one thing about America. Well, I have a lawyer I really like. His name is Bob Hasday. He works at Duane Morris. So I called Bob up and said, I want to put you in my book, and this is what you're going to do. And he said, hold on, I got to check with management. And he came back and said, okay, put me in the book. So Bob Hasday is in the book. Factor Man is probably going to try and monetize this phenomenal algorithm, so he's going to need an investor. I have a favorite investor. His name is Brian Finn. He used to be the president of Credit Suisse. If you've seen the movie Barbarians at the Gate, he actually plays a role in that movie. There's somebody playing Brian Finn, so I called Brian up and said, I'm writing a book, and I want you to be in the book, and this is what you're going to do. And he said, go for it. So I tried to make the book absolutely as close to reality as I could, except for the fact that this one guy, he's the 21st century version of Victor Frankenstein, he's made this incredible discovery that lets him change the world. some things I didn't have any experience. So there's a Chinese assassin who's trying to kill him because they don't want the technology to get out. I don't know any Chinese assassins, so I just made her up. But by and large, the technology is real. Somebody could tomorrow solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
I was working on it again this morning. And if they solve it, most computer scientists believe it can't be solved, but some believe it can be solved. And if somebody solves it, the world in a heartbeat is a very different place.
Mm.
And the story of how it gets from here to there is going to be interesting, whether it's like in Factor Man or reality decides to tell it a little differently. But everything in Factor Man, you know, the science is accurate. And one of the things that made the book fun for me is I kept the science accurate. So, you know, you talked earlier about the extent to which movies sensationalize anything.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to. I had a problem that was sensational in and of itself, and I just had to write it honestly and keep up. So that was great.
Yeah. Well, what were the thoughts going through your mind as you're actually coming up with a concept for the novel, for the book, and then even as you're writing, because this is, yeah, you've written hundreds of articles, but you've never written a novel before. And I understand that doing something like this, telling a story of this nature, certainly you had the technological knowledge in the background there to infuse that into the book. But what about this, the narrative aspect of it?
It was fun.
Yeah?
And, you know, I wrote a textbook on AI. There are so many jokes in that textbook because why wouldn't you?
Why not?
I give a lot of talks. And my talks, the audience always laughs. And at the end, everyone tells me how much they enjoyed it. And when you give a talk, you're telling a story. So I have lots of experience telling stories. And, you know, putting it on paper, I had people tell me it wasn't going to work. I mean, Bob Hasday, the lawyer himself, said, "Matt, don't write a novel. Scientists can't write novels. Are you crazy?" And now he says he wants Ben Stiller to play him in the movie. So he's completely turned around. But I tell stories all the time. I run software companies. I meet with investors. I have to tell them a story. I meet with customers. I have to tell them a story. My employees, I try and be a little more candid with, but everything is about explaining what you're thinking.
Mm.
And, you know, so it's all, at some level, it's all storytelling. So I didn't have any trouble at all.
Well, very cool. And it just kind of flowed out. How long did it take you to write?
It took about 6 months.
Well, it's a good
thing. Mostly I was hiding when I wrote it. My wife said she didn't want me to write it until I got out of one of my companies, and I just couldn't help myself. Once I started, I just couldn't stop, so she's forgiven me.
It's just, well,
but
that's
I was sort of hiding in the back office typing away.
And, of course, you do dedicate the book to your wife, as a matter of fact, who is a computer science scientist.
She is. I am so ridiculously lucky. She's amazing, a way better person than I am, the best thing about my life yesterday and today and tomorrow, every day individually, let alone the totality of them. She's just amazing.
I think that a lot of us would tend to agree with what you've stated about our own respective spouses, our own respective wives. We feel like I married way out of my class. She's out of my league. I don't know what the heck she was thinking.
Well, Pam says she married me out of pity because I kept asking her and she was tired, so she eventually just said yes.
She gave in. She capitulated. I understand. Very, very interesting stuff. Let me take you on another sojourn in terms of both astrophysics and AI, both high-end science subjects, if you will. What was it like for you as you were growing up, going to school, and what were the interests? Were they astrophysics and or computers and that type of thing, or were you baseball, football, basketball, and
no,
that kind
I was
of
a
stuff?
Nerd.
You were a nerd back then,
I
too.
I was a nerd.
Okay.
Computers, not so much. I was in high school before my school. My school had access to a computer. So computers sort of had to come relatively late in my life. But I always knew, you know, I loved math, I loved science, I still do. I love my wife, too, and she wasn't around then, but math and science were. And it was just clear that I was you know, I was designed to be a mathematician.
Hmm. I found it interesting, too, and you talked about how a lot of folks would find a lot of difficulty in seeing the beauty in numbers. And I actually, we watched that movie with Russell Crowe, The Beautiful Mind. That was what it was.
Uh-huh.
And supposedly a true story. And then I'm going to kind of put that one together along with the movie about Temple Grandin. And the way that she saw things, and of course, the way he saw things. And I found it fascinating that they were actually able to, in some fashion at least, share with us those concepts, which speaks to me of how differently we each see things.
And I think that's fair. And I don't think... I know I see things differently than the people around me. I've spoken to my kids about it, about how they think and how I think, and it's different, but everybody sees the world through their own lens.
Yeah.
And I have no idea. This is testable, I think, but I have no idea how you would, but it's certainly testable in theory, whether I was a mathematician when I was born or whether I owe it to my parents for exposing me to mathematical things early. But I certainly, it's not, I don't want anybody listening to think that I'm sort of running away from mankind to the relative security of numbers. It's not like that at all. And I do fine with people. You know, I love talking to people. I love my job and the fact that it puts me in front of all these different people. But mathematics, it's just this unbelievably beautiful order underlying everything. And I just love being in that world. I love doing mathematics. I think when I talk about mathematics and a lot of people talk about God, I think we're actually talking about the same thing. It's just this infinitely generous, tranquil, ever-present thing. And I just call it mathematics, and somebody else will call it God, but it gives us the same things, and we feel the same way when we interact with it or try to, so that's how I look at it.
It sounds to me also like your physical, mental, emotional world is also intertwined, as you have just described God and numbers or mathematics, is intertwined with your spiritual life.
Well, yes, because, I mean, Pam and I go to church every week, and it matters to me that we do. But it really is the case. I mean, for me, you know, when the pastor talks about God, I just translate that mathematics in my head, and it all works.
Yeah.
So how lucky am I that I do have a company to run. But I also get to do a significant amount of research, which is doing mathematics. So I my job is to interact with God. It's awesome. And I get paid better than a pastor does, so it's all fantastic. But I do. It's totally all tangled up for me. And I would be incredibly sad if it were somehow untangled and separated.
Do you believe that you have ever received direct inspiration or information from that higher place, God, or for that matter, your intuition?
I don't know that makes sense. So here you have God, this entity. I'm gonna do it all in the God language for a minute.
Okay.
You have this entity that is outside of time for sure. Everybody seems to agree on that. So I don't know how an entity outside of time can speak. We're making God human when we talk about that. I think that there are times when we understand God better and times when we understand God less well. And when we understand him better, it probably feels like he is talking to us. And now it's an easy jump to mathematics. There are times when you can prove a theorem and there are days when you can't. And the day when you finally manage to prove the theorem it sort of feels like mathematics is talking to you, but in reality, you somehow just found yourself in a place that's a little bit closer to it.
Hmm.
So again, I think the analogy continues to work.
Yeah.
So I never think mathematics is talking to me. I don't anthropomorphize it like that.
Hmm.
But I often think there are moments when I can see it a little more clearly.
Right. By the way, going back to something you said earlier as far as the media and movies and television, when The Big Bang Theory first came out, I love watching the show. It's just it's not just strictly for the comedy, but for what they talk about. And I was talking with a physicist who also loves the show. And actually, he went online and bought a bunch of the Sheldon T-shirts. I said, is what they're talking about real? I mean, are they really using the right terminology? Oh, 100%.
They are pretty much.
Yeah.
I certainly still know enough to know when someone's pulling the wool over my eyes. There are times when they screw it up.
Yeah. But, hey, you know, they're not physicists.
Well, I think they have physicists helping them. They must.
I think so.
I mean, Stephen Hawking used to appear every now and then, and he certainly knows a bit of physics. And there are times when they do mess it up because they have to for a plot point. There was some series of episodes about miniaturizing some quantum whatever.
Oh, that their device, yeah, their guidance system.
Yeah, the device in the Air Force. And that was sort of stretching things.
Yeah.
And in real life, it would be very unlikely for a Sheldon to build anything ever because theoretical physicists tend not to do that. But in terms of overall respectability, I think it's great. I mean, yeah, the physics, roughly speaking, is real. The words are good. What's on the whiteboards tends to be pretty decent.
Mm-hmm.
So good for them. I'm
curious, too. It seems as though we get the names of these scientists that are, it sounds to me like they're all working solo. Are there collaborative efforts, or do scientists, from your perspective, have, you know, substantial egos that, no, this is my work and I don't want you even looking at it because you could have the answer that would, then you'd get all the credit kind of stuff. Is that doesn't, how does
it
that work?
It happens a little.
Okay.
So, first of all, there's a big difference between theoretical science and experimental science.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the people who do the gravitational wave analysis now, that's a huge team. The people who looked for the Higgs boson, huge team. So the papers that come out in Nature or in Science or in Physical Review will have, you know, dozens of authors. The theoretical work tends much more to be done by individuals. There is still some, I remember when I was doing my thesis, I took, my thesis advisor actually had a list of problems on a piece of paper on his back wall, and you could claim one, you could check it out. And I checked out one of the problems, and I figured out how to solve it. I just got lucky. And all of a sudden, a whole bunch of things became possible. And one of the postdocs in my group started working on the same stuff, trying to use the techniques I had just discovered. And I was traumatized. I thought, oh my gosh, he's going to do my thesis work, and I'm never going to get a PhD, and it's all going to be terrible. And it turns out none of that matters. I mean, on the theoretical side, when you do a piece of work, you're always better suited to follow it with the next piece of work than anyone else because you figured the first piece out.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't a whole lot, you know, there's a little bit of competition and cutthroat stuff, but I think by and large, scientists are in it for the science and they want to push back the frontiers of knowledge and they care about, you know, whether they get credit and whether they get tenure. And they care about whether the discoveries they make are used for good or for ill, but they never care so much that they stop doing the work.
Yeah. Well, and of course, that's like in any industry, quite honestly, any job, any career, what have you. Before we let you go, I want to thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us your story and your insights, not only in reference to Factor Man, which is available at mattginsburg.com. And I'm going to ask you, any relation to the justice?
No. She
spells
it differently than I do, so no. She does not have that privilege.
So she's... I was going to say she spells it wrong is what you're saying.
No one's ever right or wrong. She spells it differently.
She just spells it differently. And if you ever find yourself here in Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. This is fascinating stuff because even from the standpoint of metaphysics, we still have to deal with the physical world. And we've got to figure out ways of dealing with it better than we have been. We're not doing terrible, but we there's always room for improvement. And then I have three final questions for you, if I may, before we wrap up, because I know you've got to go. You've got to run to your next interview. And again, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. Totally.
First question is, who is Matt Ginsberg?
He's just another guy. He's a father and a husband and a corporate executive because no one else would do it when somebody had to, and a scientist and a stunt pilot and a novelist and a magician, and he's old enough that he's had a chance to learn to do all these things.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Which piece of it? I mean, the companies I run, one of them connects cars to traffic lights and potentially can reduce human carbon emissions by 200 million tons a year. That would be amazing. In my spare time, I still work on that theoretical problem, and if I solved that, that would for sure be amazing. I want my kids to thrive. I want my wife and the charity she runs that helps kids who are at risk of sex trafficking, I want those to do well and make a big difference in the world. Everything I do 100%, and I'm completely committed to it, and I want it to make the world a better place.
Okay, and that may answer the third final question. What is your life's purpose?
Well, my son would tell you it's to piss people off, but what I tell myself when I look in the mirror is I want to leave the world a better place than I found it.
You and me both, my friend. You and me both.
There you go.
Matt Ginsberg, thank you once again for joining us. Factor Man is the title of the book, and mattginsberg.com is the website. We'll be linked to it. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.